Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on crime is a growth industry right after this. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it's regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, and the Family Court. And the best part about it all is that you have no input into or say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of it. And if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important and the single most expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage, and you probably know a whole lot less about it than you do your military obligation or your house payments. Now, 67% of all marriages in the United States end in divorce. But whether you're a husband or a wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or to defend against any breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you should know and understand the terms and conditions of that marriage contract before you marry, and you should write that contract yourself instead of having the state write it for you. So whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my free general law CD package and let me share some vital information with you about the law and this marriage contract. Just call direct. The number is 417-273-4967. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. If you're online, you can go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's an easy one. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. The law enforcement growth industry. It's a subject that I've covered before, but I got to taking a look the other day that concerning law enforcement here in my local area. There's a big push on to put cameras at the major intersections such as Battlefield and Sunshine to catch people who are running the red lights. And I looked at that and I said, I wonder if the people of Springfield are going to eat that, if they're going to believe that crap. But the answer is yes, they are. They just swallowed it up hook, line, and sinker. And as I watched it, I said, I think these people are probably either extremely ignorant or they're insane, one or the other. I'm not quite sure. Now, I'm not talking about the people that are putting the cameras up. Those people are very sane, very logical. They've got an agenda and they're carrying it out. What I'm talking about is the people that have bought into, that is the news leader, that's the newspaper, that's the people that are driving cars, into the aspect of the safety that is coming out of the cameras photographing cars running the red lights. And the answer is the public has eaten it up. They love it. They think it's the greatest thing since sliced white bread. And I got to thinking about crime is a growth industry. And so what we're doing is we're making a crime out of a normal, everyday garden variety activity. We did that with seatbelts. In most countries in the world, most of the activities that people carry on normally, each and every day, just day in and day out, are actually crimes here in the United States. And buckling your seatbelt is one of those. You know, people get into cars and they get into trucks all over the world, and they drive from here to there. And maybe they've got a seatbelt on, maybe they don't. But it's not a crime in most places. Here in the United States, it's a crime in every state in the union. You know, save for maybe one or two. And the same thing with running a red light. Now, let me take you through this. We all know that when the light turns red, that means stop. And when the light turns green, that means go. So here in the United States, we have a traffic system that works pretty well, at least it has in my lifetime, and I haven't noticed that there was any great problem with it. If the light is red and you're approaching the intersection, you're supposed to stop. Most people do. In fact, I think everybody does. Occasionally, somebody may be asleep at the switch and run through the red light. If there's somebody else in the intersection going in the opposite direction, there may be an accident. When there's an accident, we can then make a determination, well, who was it that was supposed to stop and didn't? And that would then fix the cause of the accident. Now, under Anglo-Saxon administration, that's the purpose of regulation. It isn't to generate tax revenue or to make money. The purpose behind it is to affix responsibility for a damage. And it's all worked pretty well for the last 3,000 years. Now, regulation also has another factor that comes in here. In order to enforce the regulation, we apply fines. And so If we were to catch somebody running through the red light, that is, you're driving down the street, and the light's red, you don't stop, you drive on through, the policeman's sitting there, he sees you do that, he stops you, and he says, I'm going to give you a ticket for running that red light, even though there wasn't a damage, there wasn't an accident. I'm going to give you a ticket. You go into the judge says, hey, did you run the red light? And you say, yeah, I ran the red light, and here's the money. He collects the money. The objective behind this is to enforce in you a need to stop at the red light. It's a reminder to you that you didn't do that. And so as a result of that, what we need to do is to remind you. We need to enforce upon you the need for you to stop. Pay attention is what it says. And that's been the system that we've used in this country over the last, you know, long as I can remember, 50, 75 years, maybe longer. There's a new element that has just been introduced. And that is, as we fine people for these regulatory misdeeds or these accidents or these lapses in memory, we discover that we generate a certain amount of revenue. So years ago, when I was in Boise, Idaho, there was a piece came out in the paper that said that the Boise City government is operated by, or the budget for the Boise City government, which at that time was around $20 million a year, was financed by 8% of the traffic fines that were collected in the city. Well, you know, it doesn't take you very long to figure out, you know, 8% of $20 million, you know, that's $800,000 per $10 million. That's about $1.6 million. Now, I got to thinking about that, and I said, geez, if everybody obeyed the law, didn't violate any laws for a whole year, the city budget would be out of balance by approximately, you know, 10%. So 10% of the budget in round numbers is being financed through these fines. Well, now, city officials, you know, they're not ignorant. They can see the numbers out there, and surely some city official must say, the more violations of the regulations that exist, then the more money we can make that we can then spend on other political activities. The real purpose behind these fines today is revenue generation, and it generates a lot of revenue. It generates revenue for the cities, the counties, and the state, and all three of them benefit from these violations, these lapses in our collective minds as we run red lights and stop signs and drive on the wrong side of the road and turn without signaling and things like that, and so the policeman catches us. Well, the policeman isn't always there. And so there's a tremendous amount of revenue out here that's being lost because the policeman isn't there to write the ticket so that we can collect the revenue. So one of two things comes to mind. Either one, we need more policemen, or we need some other methodology whereby we can catch more people who are violating more laws so that we can collect more revenue. And here comes high tech. Somebody came up with the idea that we need to install a camera at the traffic light, so that when somebody runs through the red light, we'll get his picture. All right, so this camera is set up at Battlefield and Sunshine. Worked like a shot, and so now they're putting them in all over town. And here's what happens. You're driving down the street, see, and you're looking ahead a block or two, and you see the light is green, and the speed limit is 35 miles an hour, so you're tooling along at 35. Now, if you're like I am, you know, you're sitting there always wondering, is that light going to turn on me? And how far away from the intersection am I going to be when the light turns? It goes from green to yellow, and then from yellow to red. And so during the period of time that the light turns yellow, we have to make a decision. Should we step on the gas and run through on yellow because we're that close to the intersection, or should we slam on the brakes and throw the kid into the dashboard and break his nose? Well, if you had your kid buckled in, I guess that wouldn't be a problem, but, you know, most of us are sitting there, you know, on the edge of our seat saying, well, I think I'll gun it, and we go through the intersection. And that's the guy they're after. The guy that guns it and goes through the intersection. Because, you see, the second that the bumper of your car goes across the two white crosswalk marks, they take a picture. Kerplunk, here's the picture. Now, was your car ahead of or behind that? And then if it's ahead of, then they give you a ticket, whether you went through or you didn't. I mean, you can stop, but you went too far ahead, take your picture, hey, you ran the red light, and we're going to give you a ticket. Now, here in the States, it's kind of a big hassle, you know, going down the traffic court and dinking around one thing and another. So most people, rather than go in and argue with the judge or to tell the judge, oh, wait a minute, you made a mistake here, I didn't run the red light, or blah, 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 they just pay the fine. 99.9% of the time, or maybe it's 99.9999999% of the time, we just go in there and pay the damn money and walk out, because it doesn't happen very often. But I got to thinking about that, and I said to myself, wait a minute, this doesn't have anything to do with traffic safety. Nobody has ever been killed, injured, or been involved in a traffic accident because somebody ran the yellow light. Hasn't happened. Can't happen. It's impossible. It's impossible. Think about it. By the time the light turns yellow and you're approaching the intersection, the traffic that is coming in the opposite direction, I don't mean straight ahead from you, but from the two sides of you, hell, they've been stopped for either 1 or 2 minutes. They're all stopped. So when you go through the light on yellow, and halfway through the intersection, the yellow light turns to red. That got you. Dead to right. The light turned to red while you were in the intersection, traveling at 35 miles an hour through the intersection. The traffic that's coming from the side street from the two sides of you have been stopped for a minute. Unless, of course, now this is a possibility. Unless, of course, there is a super monster dragster that can go from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 0.03 of a second. And the second that the light turns green in his favor, he guns it, blasts into the intersection that you're going through. You can't have an accident here, boys and girls. Tain't physically possible. And there isn't any traffic engineers out there. There isn't any city officials or light signal people over there or highway patrolmen or anybody else that doesn't know that. And that's why I said when I opened, I said, I just wonder, are the people in Springfield, are they going to eat this up? Are they going to buy into this thing over here? Because they're telling us, we're doing this for traffic safety. We're doing this to protect you from people that run red lights. Well, boys and girls, the guy that runs the red light is running the red light after the other traffic has already begun. The light's green for the other guys. It's red for us, and we run through the red light. Now, that's gonna end up in an accident. Nobody in his right mind would do that for fear of having an accident. The guys that they're catching aren't the guys that are running the red light after it has turned green for the opposite side. The guys that they're giving the tickets to are the guys that are running the yellow lights that turns red while they're going through the intersection. And besides that, there's a one-second delay. There's 1 second there where the light is red in all four directions. And then it turns green for the other guys. It's already got a built-in safety factor that's built in. So they simply took a look at it and said, we can't have a traffic cop at every red light, but we can put a camera at every red light. And during the course of the day, we can get 6 or 8 people a day going through on the yellow light that turns red in the middle of the intersection, and therefore we'll get him for running the red light. And everybody says, well, yeah, I guess you got me running the red light. Hell, the guy wasn't running the red light. He was running the yellow light. And here's the point. We have made a crime out of something that's as normal as going to the bathroom. And we did it for the purposes of generating revenue. It's nothing more than a tax, nothing more, nothing less. It has absolutely nothing to do with health, safety, and welfare of the public or traffic safety. And everybody involved in it knows that. And what we're dealing with here in the United States is a prison system that has just gone nuts. We have 2 million people locked up in jail. Hell, we got more people locked up in jail than we have farmers. We spend more money on jails and prisons than we do on education, well, higher education. It costs $56 a day to keep people locked up in jail on average nationwide. We got one jail in this country costs $425,000 a year to keep one prisoner locked up for 1 year, $425,000. I got to ask you, boys and girls, do you really want to spend $56 a day to lock some guy up for something that in most countries in the world isn't even a crime, and which in this country wasn't even a crime 25, 30, 40 years ago? Let's take seatbelts for instance over here and talk about them here for a second. You know, there was a time in America when we didn't even have seatbelts in our cars. And yet, you know, we got in our cars and we drove from here to there and we went from there to here and one thing and another and we seemed to get by all right. Now, it is true when you have an accident that you may be thrown out of the car. And it is true that you may have your seatbelt on, have an accident, get killed with your seatbelt buckled. But the general consensus of opinion is that if you're wearing your seatbelt and you're involved in an accident, your chances of surviving it and having less injuries, that is, you know, if you don't have your seatbelt on, you have an accident, maybe you go through the windshield. If you got your seatbelt on, you don't go through the windshield because it restrains you in the car. So over time, we took a look at these accidents, and traffic safety specialists pay attention to these kinds of things, and they say, you know, if you could get everybody to wear a seatbelt and just take the same number of accidents that you have every year, we could probably save 10,000 people a year from getting killed. And we could probably save, you know, maybe another 100,000 people a year from more serious injuries and accidents, which might kill some people, but they won't die because they were wearing their seatbelt. And then we can take an accident that maybe would have cost a guy maybe, 2 weeks in the hospital recuperating, and maybe we can reduce that to a day in the hospital or an in-and-out checkup or something like that. We can prevent a lot of injury. We can mitigate a lot of injury, and we can mitigate, and we can probably save a lot of lives. And so that makes a lot of sense. That's part and parcel with traffic safety. And it just makes a lot of sense, you know, that you should buckle your seatbelt. I don't deny that. But should we make it a crime not to buckle your seatbelt? I think that's where the gist of it comes in. Now, there's a lot of do-gooders out there, and they mean well. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, and they probably mean real good for you. And they want you to buckle your seatbelt, and they want to tell you to come up in. They say, well, look, can you see how logical this seatbelt is? And so you and I say, well, yeah, I can see how logical that seatbelt is. Well, then you should buckle your seatbelt, and I'll agree with you. And I should buckle my seatbelt. But I don't buckle my seatbelt, and now the do-gooder looks around and he says, you know, I told that guy Gordon that buckling his seatbelt would be a good idea, and he agreed with me. But he doesn't buckle his seatbelt, so therefore I'm just mad as hell, and I think that we should punish Gordon now for not buckling his seatbelt. In other words, it isn't that I'm committing a crime. In the traditional sense, when we look at the Ten Commandments, a crime is where you breach your contract and or cause somebody a damage to his life, liberty, or property. Now, if I come over and steal your lawnmower, I cause you a damage. If I run over your lawnmower with my truck, I cause you a damage. If it's my fault that I ran over your lawnmower, I should compensate you for that damage. And so we have a long history of negligence law goes back thousands of years. People that are negligent, people that are careless, people that are deliberate and cause other people damages to their life, liberty, and property ought to pay for that. And we have a system of justice in which we require people to pay for those damages. And we all agree that that's probably the best solution. We got it from God himself. And we think that that's fair. We call that justice. Justice. Let me ask you this. I'm not wearing my seatbelt. Do you think that it's justice to put me in jail because I don't wear my seatbelt? Many people would say, well, yeah, we think that's pretty just, because we enacted a law that said, if you don't buckle your seatbelt, we're going to lock you up for 90 days. And so I just wanted to ask you, but why? Well, because wearing your seatbelt is a good idea. I never argued with you. I agreed with you. It's a great idea. But my question to you is, why do you want to lock me up for 90 days because I don't perform on your good idea? Now, there's a lot of good ideas out there that a lot of people probably ought to do. Now, one of them is, I think it would be a good idea if people didn't practice adultery. And God agrees with me. He thinks that it's a good idea that you don't practice adultery. Maybe I should reword that. The guy that thought it up first was God, and he gave us a law, and he said, thou shalt not commit adultery. He got a little more serious. He called it a capital felony. He said he wants the death penalty exacted for people that don't practice that. Now, normal people out in society, when you say, we think we ought to take all adulterers and adulteresses out and stone them to death, they just recoil in absolute horror, and they say, oh, my God, that's not kind, that's not gentle, that's not fair, that's not just, and we ought not to do that, and so we don't. We don't. God, on the other hand, never prescribed any penalty for me or you or anybody else for not buckling your seatbelt, and you people want to lock me up for 90 days if I don't buckle my seatbelt, or fine me, take my car away from me, punish me, raise hell with me if I don't follow your good idea and buckle my seatbelt. And I'm sitting here asking the question, why do you want to do that? How does that benefit you? And it costs you $56 a day. Now, if I was really incorrigible, at $56 a day times 90 days, which is the penalty here, it's $5,000. Is it really worth $5,040 to you to lock me up for 90 days for not buckling my seatbelt? I mean, if I walked up to you and I said, I want you to write a check for $5,040 to pay for my incarceration because I ain't buckling my seatbelt, how excited would you be about enforcing that seatbelt law on me if it cost you $5,040? You know, I don't think you do-gooders out there really believe in your cause to that degree. As long as somebody else is paying the bill, I guess, let's lock them up and throw the key away. And that's what I wanted to bring to your attention, because the cost of this incarceration, the cost to all of us, not just you, not just me, all of us, have to pay $56 a day out of our pockets to support the law enforcement growth industry. And crime is a growth industry. It is a deliberate, intended agenda of politicians and people in positions of power to create more and more crime each and every year for their own benefit and their own profit. And I'm sitting here saying, do we really want to buy that? And the answer may be yes, we do. Maybe as a group or as a society, we want to buy more and more law and order. We want to buy more and more justice. We want to buy more and more prisons, more and more policemen, more and more laws, so that we can have more and more restraint. And I got to ask the question, though, why do we want to do that? If I said to you, I want you to write me a check for $5,040 to pay for my incarceration for 90 days, or you could take and write a check for $5,040 to the Carnival Lines and take a carnival cruise, which would you rather do? Bring justice and law and order and punish me for not buckling my seatbelt for the $5,000, or take your wife on a carnival cruise for a couple of weeks? Because for the amount of money that we're spending on this law enforcement growth industry and what we're getting back from it, you know, I might ask you, how much extra safety do you receive in your everyday life from locking up some guy that doesn't buckle his seatbelt for 90 days, as opposed to locking up some guy that commits murder? You know, maybe works for Murder Incorporated. Now, we have the violent criminals and we have nonviolent criminals, and we lock both of them up in the same jail. We've got people that smoke dope, and I don't think smoking dope is a very good idea, but there's a lot of people out there doing it. And there's a lot of people who don't buckle their seatbelts, and I think that those people ought to buckle their seatbelts. But I, for one, do not want to pay $5,000 to lock you up because you smoke dope, or to lock you up because you don't buckle your seatbelt. Now, I could see a little more logic in locking you up if you're out here murdering people. Like, I could see a little logic behind that. But, you know, even locking people up for murder is a waste of our time, effort, energy, and resources. There's a better solution, and we got that solution from God. He told us, when you get a murderer out here and he kills people, you got to kill him. You need to kill these murderers. We don't. We lock them up for life, and at $56 a day, that's the average, and you lock a guy up for life. Let's figure this out for a second here. Christians ordinarily can't count, so I'm going to help you. Jews can count. Christians can't. Let's take a guy who's 30 years old, and he gets real mad one night, and he kills his wife. He just ticked off at her, didn't like her, so he killed her. And so we try this guy, and we put him in the process over here, and we run him through, and we find him guilty of murder, and so we sentence him to life imprisonment without possibility of parole. And we do that because we're afraid that if we were to parole this guy, if we were to let this guy out, he might kill somebody again. It's kind of like having a dangerous animal. You know, you got to lock this guy up. You got to do something with him. You got to do something. Okay, now, it costs more in the United States to sentence a guy to death. It costs $3.5 million to kill every prisoner. Yeah, that's the average. It takes 20 years to get him dead, and $3.5 million. That's another part of this law. Crime is the growth industry that I'm talking about. But in addition to that, let's just try this one out. If we charged, 365 days in a year, and a guy's 30 years old, and he lives to be an average of 75 years, which is the average lifespan, this guy's going to live for 45 years, isn't he? So if we take 45 times 365 times $56, that's $919,800. That's cheaper than killing him. Because it costs $3.5 million to kill him. So it is true, but at $919,000, we're pushing $1 million to lock this guy up for the rest of his life. And he's so damn dangerous, you don't dare turn him loose. So he's not going to be a productive member of society. He's not going to work and pay taxes for the national defense, but he gets defended by the same nuclear submarines that you and I have to work for, pay our taxes, and pay for, doesn't he? He gets all the benefits that society offers. Oh, albeit locked up in jail, and pays for none of it, and then you and I, on top of paying for our own share, have to pay for his share at the rate of $1 million for his lifetime. Don't you think that we could come up with a more efficient system of dealing with, and here's what we do, when we have a dog, and the other day there was one in the news later, it was a pit bull, and he killed a child in Springfield. The child got into this guy's yard, and the dog mauled the child, and the child died. And so they took the dog out and killed it. And now I guess they're talking about investigating, they're going to prosecute the guy that owned the dog, although the dog was in his own yard. The kid went into the neighbor's yard. But the dog killed the kid, and so naturally they killed the dog. Now, when a dog kills a kid, we take the dog out and we kill the dog. It doesn't cost $3.5 million and take 20 years. We just take the dog down, shoot him up, and we put him to sleep, and that's the end of the dog. Now, why is it then that when you have a fellow human being, he goes out and he kills a kid? It takes 20 years and $3.5 million. Well, because the people who benefit from that $3.5 million in the 20 years of this guy locked up in jail, they're making a lot of money off of that. And that's basically the law enforcement growth industry. It's the judges, the probation officers, the defense lawyers, and the sociologists and psychologists and the doctors and the guards and the prison and the jail and all the people that are associated with the prison and all the people that are associated with this growth industry. A guy by the name of Howard Hughes died 25 or 30 years ago. He was a very wealthy fellow. And do you know his estate has not been settled yet? And I'll make this prediction. As long as there's $1 million left in the Howard Hughes estate, it'll never be settled, because as long as it's open and in probate, there's lawyers somewhere making money off of it. It doesn't take 25 or 30 years to settle an estate or to close out a probate. But the people that are making money off of it are going to keep it in operation and milk it as long as they can. And that's what's going on here with crime. The people that are profiting from it are profiting off of you and I, the taxpayer. And they're profiting off of the growth industry in crime. And they're creating more and more crime, and you and I are buying it. So I thought I would bring this to your attention, just to ask, are you sure you won't really want to buy this product? Because I don't want to buy it. I think it's a bad product. I don't think we need to spend $3.5 million on killing a man who is a murderer. I don't think we need to do that. We don't spend that kind of money on a rabid dog, do we? It doesn't cost any more to kill a human than it does a dog. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed to the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, this Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use in this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we endorse or recommend will reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications cited here on the law are maybe hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the law or an editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the law hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the first article by Tom Lowe, or Lau, L-O-W-E, Awakening to the Prison Crisis. You can get a copy of this at www.jacksonprogressive.com. It's all one word, jacksonprogressive.com, dealing with the law enforcement in prisons. He said, I was pleasantly surprised to see two articles on the prison explosion recently in the Clarion Ledger, both of them on the front of the perspective section of the newspaper's weekly stab at going beyond the usual superficiality of the daily press. The articles, one by Mark Weisbrot of the Preamble Center and the other by Timothy Lynch of the Cato Institute, were in rare concurrence on the subject of incarceration. We have far too many people behind bars, mostly because of the drug war. Now, the statistics are alarming. And Weisbrot points out that the number of prisoners has multiplied sixfold over the past 27 years, and that we will shortly, if not already, have 2 million people behind bars. The only country in the world with a higher incarceration rate is Russia. Our crime rate, on the other hand, is unremarkable when compared with the crime rates of other countries, including Russia, with the exception of homicide, which can be explained by the proliferation and easy availability of guns in this country. Now, this isn't something of which citizens of the land of the free and the home of the brave should be proud of. In addition to the human suffering created by imprisonment per se, decisions to get tough on crime by making the punishment harsher has other nasty side effects. As Ron Welch, well-known Jackson prisoners' rights attorney, once said, prisons fill up. It doesn't make any difference how many prison beds you create. The criminal justice system is biased towards keeping all of these prison beds filled. And it's easy to do in Mississippi. Mississippi's truth in sentencing law, which took away the discretion of the parole board, has already tripled the state prison budget from $88 million in 1995 to $270 million today. Those are dollars that could have been used to raise teachers' pay or to adequately fund the universities instead of forcing the universities to raise their tuition. Let me pause here and make a comment. From 1995 to 2000, and I guess this is 2008, so we're talking about 95. Oh, it's 13 years, but let's just round it off to 10 years. In about 10 years' time, the number of dollars spent went from $88 million to $270. Well, obviously that was a good value, because the people of Mississippi have agreed to pay $270 million a year instead of $88 million a year to incarcerate three times as many people. And I don't want to second-guess the people of Mississippi. Obviously, they think it's money well spent, and it's money that needs to be spent for the public good. But let me ask you this. If $270 million is good, wouldn't, oh, let's say, $1 billion a year be even better? See, $270 million, that's a quarter of a billion. If a quarter of $1 billion is money well spent, wouldn't four times as much, or $1 billion a year, be four times better? If $270 million a year is giving you this much peace, tranquility, and safety, wouldn't spending four times as much and putting four times as many people in prison give you four times more safety, four times more peace of mind? Now, if you're sitting there saying, well, not necessarily, well then, okay, what makes you think then that spending three times as much and going from 88 to 270 is necessarily giving you more peace of mind or greater personal safety? Just a matter of how many dollars you want to spend on this. Has anybody ever thought about, well, what did we get for our money? Now, you know, when you go out and buy a car, and you bring the car home, and you analyze it, and you take a look at the owner's manual, and you pay attention to what kind of gas you put into it, and what kind of gas mileage you get, and what kind of tires mileage you get off your tires, and one thing and another. Has anybody ever thought to look into the prison system and say, well, just exactly what are we getting for the amount of dollars that we're spending? So let me give you a number here. This is kind of a surprising number. In 1900, we put one person out of every 1,666 people in the country in prison. Get that number in your mind now? Let me run this by you again. 1900, this is 100 years ago. And we put one person in jail out of every 1,666 people that we had in the country. Today in 2000, we put one person in jail for every 210 people that we have in the country. Now, what's the difference? Is it that 100 years ago, people were more law-abiding? Or is it that we have more crimes today? Now, let's think about this pragmatically, because see, in 1900, you didn't have a seatbelt law, and you weren't locking people up for 90 days because they didn't buckle their seatbelt. And you didn't have child protection laws like you have today, and you didn't have deadbeat dads that weren't paying their child support. Now today we lock a lot of people up for not paying their child support. I got a guy called me the other day, one of my students, as a matter of fact, and he called up. He's in jail up in Ohio because he pays child support. It costs $56 a day to keep this guy locked up in jail, and you're going to say, well, he didn't pay his child support. By God, he needs to go to jail. Well, okay, I won't argue with you, but let me point out that every day you put this guy in jail, he's not working. Every day you put him in jail, he ain't paying his child support. And every day you put him in jail, it costs you $56, Bob. Now, they sentenced him to 60 days in jail. See how much this is going to cost us. 56 times 60 is $3,360. I don't know how much he owes on child support. Wouldn't we be better off if we took the same $3,360 and just gave it to his old lady? Wouldn't she be better off? Well, we said, well, we got to teach this guy a lesson. He didn't pay his child support, so we're gonna fine him by locking him up in jail. Well, okay. I don't know if it's right or wrong or good or bad. I'm not going to take up his cause or run him down one way or the other. But it's one of those nonviolent crimes. He didn't murder anybody. And he's not a threat to my health, safety, or welfare. And it's probably true. Maybe his ex-wife there does need the money. I don't know how much he owes in back child support. And maybe he ought to pay that, and maybe there ought to be a way to punish him. But locking him up in jail, I'm asking the question, do you think locking the guy up is the way to get this job done? And somebody's going to say, well, I guess nothing else worked. I don't know. What else did they try? Do you know? See, I don't know. Now, we got these drug people out here, you know. There's guys that are out here on the street buying marijuana and smoking dope and one thing and another, and that's pretty poor. I don't approve of it. But I really don't want to pay $56 a day to lock some drug addict up in jail. That's my personal opinion. I don't want to pay it. But I guess that the majority of my fellow Americans out there decided, well, that's what we want to do. We all want to tax ourselves $56 a day to lock this guy up because he smokes dope. Hell, I'd rather take the money and go on a carnival cruise. And I think a carnival cruise is about the biggest waste of money that I can think of here today, but I can't think of anything that's more wasteful than locking some jerk up in jail and me paying $56 a day for his incarceration. I mean, hell, if nothing else, as Jesus once said, he said you should have at least put my money to the exchangers so I could have come back and gotten it with usury. Anyway, we ought to go on, I guess, a little bit further here. And it says, several factors have caused us to put so many people behind bars. Modest changes in the sentences have the most significant effects. Judges, wary of public criticism for being soft on criminals, can impose longer sentences. The legislature can create new crimes to punish behavior of which it disapproves. Let's go back to our man who's locked up for 60 days. Do you think that maybe the judge was too soft on this guy? If 60 days in jail is soft, wouldn't 120 days in jail be tougher? Hell, if the guy hasn't paid his child support, why would we stop with 4 months in jail? Why don't we sentence this jerk to 4 years in jail? God, that ought to teach him a lesson. Hey, you didn't pay your child support, jerk, so we're going to lock you up for 4 years because we think 2 months in jail is too soft. 4 months is tougher. Gordon came along and said, hell, if 4 months is good, 4 years ought to be 10 times better. I mean, hell, let's be tough. Hell, if 4 years is tough, 40 years would be even tougher, wouldn't it? Why don't we sentence this guy to life in prison for not paying his child support? At some point in time, we have to say, well, that's a little excessive, don't you think? Locking a guy up for the rest of his life in jail for non-payment of child support? I mean, hell, that's about all we do to a murderer. He didn't kill his old lady. He didn't kill his kid. He just didn't support him. Well, they didn't die. They went out and supported themselves in some other way. But he was supposed to support him, and he didn't. Well, okay. I was supposed to buckle my seatbelt, and I didn't, and you weren't supposed to smoke dope, but you did. But should we lock this guy up for the rest of his life? Most people would say, well, no, that's too much. Okay, well, how much is enough? How much is enough? How much time are you going to give this guy that's going to make him pay his child support, which is what you want, and how much do we have to pay to lock this guy up at $56 a day? And where's the break-even point, and where's the point of profitability? Because so far we haven't figured that out. So far we haven't found it. Now we got 2 million people locked up in jail, and I suppose we're on our way to 4 million. Do you think that by the time we lock 4 million people up in jail that we're going to have more peace, more safety, more peace of mind, more of everything that we want by locking people up? Now, you know, God in the Bible has a solution to the crime problem. Now, we rejected his solution. Obviously, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about, and we must be smarter than God, because he told us that we need to kill murderers. And he doesn't have any provisions at all for prison. God does not use prisons as a form of punishment at all. None. He's got 28 ways to punish people, and not a single one of them calls for locking you up. Obviously, he doesn't know much about the criminal justice system. He ought to pay closer attention to us Americans, because we've got the world's greatest penal system, and God can't learn from us. But by God, we're going to teach him now, aren't we? Well, all right, now, if you think you've got enough money to pay for all of this incarceration, let's get after it. But let me read you a little bit more here. He goes on to say, these things and more have happened in California. The Prison Workers Union, did you get this one? The Prison Workers Union, this is the locked up prisoners have a union, has become a powerful political force, creating pressure on the legislature and the governor to build more prisons and fill them. They want to build more prisons and fill them. Californians recently approved a constitutional amendment which would have the effect of forcing far more juveniles to be tried as adults and taking away a judge's discretion in referring a juvenile to youth courts. Both Weisbrot and Lynch point out that the incarceration craze has had little effect on crime. I'm going to underline that. As we have locked more and more people up, it has had very little effect on crime. Over half the prison population is in for crimes involving drugs. But yet the availability and the purity of the drugs on the street have increased while the price has actually declined. God, that just shows you how well the free market system works. I mean, the free market system, the supply and demand system in drugs, it works, boys and girls. And the regulation that we've imposed upon ourselves through OSHA, the EPA, and all the regulatory agencies has driven our employers to send their workforces and their businesses to China. That's why we have outsourcing and offshore. Yeah, one of the reasons. Now, this is failure, pure and simple. In the world of business, failure on this scale would lead, if not to bankruptcy, at least to a radical reassessment of the way we do business. Not in the case of prisons, though. In spite of a veritable mountain of research findings that severe punishments reduce crime very little, if at all, the thrust is still getting tough on crime. No politician, national or local, will speak the truth and tell us that we need to change our policy. Now, let's look at insanity. You know, insanity has been defined as steadfastly adhering to the same behavior, even after the behavior fails over and over again, and it fails to achieve its objective. Now, doesn't that sound like the war on drugs? I mean, we've got this drug czar in this country, and we've got this war on drugs, and we've been fighting the drug war for as long as I can remember. And the drugs get purer and cheaper and more available than ever before. And our agriculture in this country, which we subsidize and we dote over, is disintegrating before our very eyes. as we get more and more government involvement in agriculture and more subsidies, our agriculture declines and our drug purity and availability and price all decline. We got more drugs, cheaper prices, and better quality than ever in the free marketplace, which, by the way, is the only free market in America. It's the drug market. And it just thrives. It's the biggest business in America. Drugs. Biggest industry in America. The only free market. And that's the illegal drugs. I mean, the legal drugs, it's also big and prosperous and profitable. All right, now let's take a look at, I don't think this is insanity. There are too many intelligent persons supporting the drug war for it to be merely an exercise in collective insanity. What may be inefficient and even harmful to most of us might be quite profitable to some people or corporations. As an exercise, let's examine who wins and who loses from the drug war. Listen to this. The winners are prison construction business, government contracts to build prisons. That's a winner. A winner is prison personnel. It creates jobs for guards. Here's a winner, communities with prisons, because it creates an economy. Drug lords and people that are in the illegal drug business, high prices and high profits. Prison industries with low wages benefit. The CIA and other intelligence agencies have slush funds. The makers of police equipment, defense attorneys, defense industry, Latin and South American military, the Latin and South American politicians through graft and corruption, American politicians unfriendly to minority voters, more unfavorable voters are in jail, public servants at all levels of government willing to advance the drug war in return for contributions and outright bribes from the other players who stand to gain by it, financial institutions who profit from laundering the drug money, the U.S. military whose mission and therefore power is enlarged. Those are all winners in the war on drugs. That's why we have a growth industry in the drugs and the drug war. This isn't a war on drugs, boys and girls. This is a modality whereby we can loot the taxpayers' pockets. They've got us paying for this drug war by locking people up, which keeps the prices of the product sky high. And in spite of that, prices are declining, drug purity is going up, and the profitability is getting more and more. And you and I as taxpayers are paying for all of this. And then we're locking these people up that use the drugs. And I'm sitting here saying, well, wait a minute, the people that are profiting aren't the drug users. It's the politicians, prisons, prison guards, communities with prisons, drug lords, the CIA, the makers of police equipment, the defense industry, Latin and South American militaries, Latin and South American politicians, public servants at all levels, financial institutions, and the U.S. military. They're all benefiting from the war on drugs. But you and I aren't. And the guys that we're locking up aren't. And it costs us $56 a day to lock them up so that we can keep the price of drugs high. And then they tell us they need to spend $2 billion a year on the drug war. Have we taken leave of our senses here, children? Have we just gone stark raving mad? Or just unable to count? Just unable to think? You know, it's obvious that the drug war pits a few large and powerful entities who have much to gain against the rest of us, who have far more to lose than we realize. And as often occurs, the benefits to the winners are concentrated and specific, whereas the costs to us are far more diffused and fall upon groups less politically powerful, such as youth and minorities. And in such cases, the parties with the concentrated and specific benefits usually prevail, especially when they have political power, which is the case here. They're constantly going into the Congress over here and having laws passed that benefit the drug cartels, all in the name of controlling drugs and the war on drugs. We've got to stamp out these drugs. All right, I'm out of time. And I got to remind you here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.